Houston has been in my life. Been playing my music for many, many years now. They've been around for years, thanks to your listener support. You know, community radio has always been important for people like me, people who aren't in the mainstream but yet have something to say. And I think a lot of us need that in these times. So I want to thank you for your support, and I've always loved KPFT. I hope you do too.
My friends, this is Carolyn Wonderland, and you, lucky dog, are listening to KPFT, Houston's community station.
Hi, this is Steve Gallington of the People's News, and you're listening to KPFT, Houston.
Welcome to another edition of the Progressive Forum. The Progressive Forum covers issues such as human rights, the environment, politics, and peace and justice, in addition to presenting news, commentary, and a weekly calendar of events.
This is the Progressive Forum. I'm Susan Phillips, in for Wally James. Good news! If you missed the August 9th KPFT special event with Tom Hartman, you can hear it this hour. Plus, we'll hear from Heather Cox Richardson, Lillian Kerr with a bird's eye view, and Larry Krizan with the news. But first, it's high time for the lowdown with Jim Hightower.
A gaggle of self-righteous multimillionaires are now in charge of America's poverty agencies and policies, and they've been flaunting their deeply held ignorance about poor families, almost none of whom they actually know. Consider the national embarrassment of Brooke Rollins, a patrician ideologue who is Trump's plutocratic Secretary of Agriculture. Besides promoting a corporatized food and farm system, Rollins is advocating a program of back-to-the-future peonage for poor people. We have way too many people that are taking government program that are able to work, she snorts. Bad grammar aside, she falsely asserts that 34 million able-bodied adults are freeloading on public health care. They're taking Medicaid benefits that they ought to have to earn by hard labor, she recently decreed. Her Dickensian solution? Put the moochers to work in the fields. Noting that Trump's militarized assault on immigrants has terrorized agricultural workers, thus creating a farm labor crisis, Rollins wants to hitch America's poor families to the plow. Voila, labor shortage solved, and the poor are forced to earn their medical care. What a brilliant leader, except for her rank ignorance. First, 64% of Medicaid recipients are already working, and nearly all of the rest are retirees unable to work or struggling to find jobs. Second, she's obviously unaware that agriculture is skilled work. You can't just bus city and suburban people out to the country and say, grow stuff. This is Jim Hightower saying. And third, it is beyond arrogant for a rich government autocrat who takes $220,000 a year from taxpayers, plus platinum health care benefits and a fat pension, to be pontificating about forcing undeserving poor people into hot fields to produce a nice leafy salad for her lunch.
This is the Progressive Forum on KPFT. On August 9th, KPFT held a special event featuring a talk with author and progressive political commentator Tom Hartman. KPFT's Progressive Forum is proud to present that talk to you this evening.
Good evening.
Howdy.
Good to see y'all. First of all, you know, thank you for showing up and for, you know, participating in this fundraiser, and, you know, let's help out KPFT. It's such an important resource. And special thanks to Grant, who just did a great job out here. Wally, Marlo, Sandy, Michael, Patrick, Jerry Lynn, Howard, Elise, Robin, Lillian, and all the volunteers, all the KPFT volunteers. Thank you. I wanted to talk tonight about how we got here. You know, what brought us to having a psycho rapist, 34 conviction criminal in the White House? And how did this happen? And there's a lot of possible starting points, but the one that I think is probably the most informative is 1951. In 1951, a fellow by the name of Russell Kirk wrote a book called The Conservative Mind, From Burke to Eliot, was the title of the book. And it's, to this day, the Bible of the conservative movement. You'll hear, you know, conservatives, Republicans in particular, talk about Russell Kirk all the time. At the time, Kirk was thought of as kind of, like a Curtis Yarvin, you know, kind of like this weird intellectual who's just out there and nobody takes him all that seriously, or at least Curtis Yarvin a year ago. And Edmund Burke, of course, was the British philosopher, economist, conservative, who famously said back during the American Revolutionary time, actually around the time of the French Revolution, said, it does me no harm if a man is allowed to engage in as servile a profession as a tallow maker, candle maker, or hairdresser, but it does society considerable violence if such a person is allowed to participate in governance, in other words, to vote. So that was kind of the starting point, and then T.S. Eliot was the more contemporary end on Kirk's book. But basically what Kirk was arguing was that you have to have, in order to have a functioning society, you have to have classes and orders. That's a natural thing, that there's this natural order to societies, and a caste system is a desirable thing. And basically nobody took him seriously. His argument was that there were four or five major threats to the future functionality of America. That there was the threat that if the middle class, now keep in mind, when Franklin Roosevelt came into office in 1932, or 33, in March of 33, only about 10% of America was in the middle class. When Reagan came in 81, it was 66%. We're down to 47% now as a result of 44 years of Reaganism, but in 1951, it was approaching 50%. And so one of Kirk's first arguments was if the middle class ever got too large, that would lead to the destruction of our society. Because you've got to have classes and orders, and you've got to have a large class of basically the working poor in order to keep society going, you know, grinding along. He was also very opposed to unions. His second argument was that if women ever, now keep in mind this is 1951. In 1951, you know, women couldn't sign a mortgage, they couldn't get a credit card, there was no no-fault divorce, you know, et cetera, so you couldn't get an abortion. So he said, if women ever have equal power with men, that will be another thing that will lead to the end of American society. He said, if the young people ever cease to respect their elders, that will be the end of society. And he said, if minorities, racial minorities specifically, ever acquire power equal to that of white people in the society, that'll be the destruction of our society. So these were the primary arguments that Russell Kirk was making in 1951. And really the only two people who took him seriously were Barry Goldwater and William F. Buckley. And, you know, Buckley writing his famous 1954 article about how, the white race is the superior race and all this kind of stuff, basically endorsing Russell Kirk. And then came the 60s. And when the 60s happened, we were flat on in the middle of the civil rights movement. The birth control pill was legalized in 1961, so by 1965, by the mid-1960s, you had a women's rights movement, a women's movement that was just going full tilt boogie. You had the Vietnam War, so you had young people who were, you know, young men burning their draft cards and protesting in the streets. And you had a substantial union movement that had taken us from the less than 50% middle class to the more than 60% middle class that Reagan inherited and then tried to destroy. And at that point, Kent State was happening, and Bloody Sunday was happening, and the Edmund Pettus Bridge was happening, and all this stuff was going on after the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act were passed. A lot of Republicans suddenly became converts to Russell Kirk and you know, just adopted this belief that these were all bad things, that these were that this was not societal evolution, that these were not positive trends in society, that these were the things that were going to just absolutely and utterly destroy America. So what came out of this was what, you know, we generally refer to as the Reagan Revolution. In 1971, Lewis Powell, who was a tobacco lawyer in Virginia, wrote this memo saying that, you know, and he was citing Russell Kirk also. Saying that, you know, conservatives need to take control of the universities, they need to take control of the courts, they need to take control of the media, they need to take control of government, they need to take, you know, basically every, you know, sort of the 1960s version of the Seven Mountain Mandate, you know, of all these aspects of society that conservatives needed to just grab hold of and own and control. And this memo so impressed Richard Nixon that the next year, 72, he put Lewis Powell on the Supreme Court. 4 years later, in 1976, Lewis Powell was one of the it was a 5-4 decision, one of the votes for a Supreme Court decision called Buckley versus Vallejo. William F. Buckley's brother, it was a very wealthy family, he was running for the Senate from New York, and he had a lot of money and he wanted to be able to spend it on his own campaign. At that time, there were these campaign finance laws that said you can't do that. And so he sued, and it went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court ruled in 76 in Buckley versus Vallejo that a wealthy person can finance their own campaign because money is the same thing as speech in the political context, because money can be used to purchase advertising on television or on radio or whatever, and therefore money is speech. Speech is protected by the First Amendment, political speech in particular, and therefore unlimited money basically coming from the candidates themselves. This was the beginning, 76 was the beginning of the time. At that point in time, a very small minority of people in the House of Representatives were wealthy. And there were more rich people in the Senate, but not like today, nothing like today. And this is when the Republican Party started actively recruiting rich people to run for political office because they could finance their own campaigns. 2 years later, in 1978, in a decision called First National Bank versus Bilotti, there was this law in Massachusetts that said that a corporation could not put money into a political campaign unless that campaign had to do with the business of that corporation. They could speak up on their own behalf. If somebody was trying to pass a law about banking, a bank could lobby against it, but not if it had nothing to do with banking. And there was this initiative in Massachusetts that had to do with abortion, and the First National Bank of Boston was helping fund it. And so Frank Bilotti, the Attorney General of Massachusetts, sued the First National Bank. In this case, First National Bank of Boston versus Bilotti, went to the Supreme Court. And Lewis Powell himself wrote the decision in 1978, again citing Russell Kirk, and saying that not only is money free speech, but corporations are also persons. Now, there's a predicate to that. I wrote a whole book about it called Unequal Protection that goes back to 1886 and the Santa Clara County versus Southern Pacific Railroad case. But that had not really made its way into law the way that it did in 1976 with this Supreme Court ruling. And so the consequence of this was that suddenly we shifted basically from democracy to oligarchy. And the real easy way to understand this is this contest that I've been running on my program for the 23 years I've been on the air, which is if you can name one piece of legislation since the Reagan Revolution. Now, this is not true of the Eisenhower presidency. He would be a Democrat today, in the 1950s. But if you can name one piece of legislation since Ronald Reagan's presidency that was written, that was primarily authored by Republicans, that passed a Republican majority in the House and Senate, was signed into law by a Republican president, whose principal beneficiary is the average working person, you win the prize, right? And the prize is like an autographed book or something. And nobody has ever won that prize, because there literally isn't one. I mean, we went from passing all kinds of stuff that benefited average working people, right? I mean, in the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, when Dwight Eisenhower ran for re-election in 1956, his whole campaign pitch was that he had added, in the first 4 years of his presidency, he had added 4 million new people to the union rolls and multiple millions of people, he had expanded Social Security. I mean, like I said, today he would be considered a Democrat. So you had, starting in the 30s, we got the right to unionize, we got unemployment insurance, we got Social Security, we got workplace safety standards, we got the 8-hour day, we got the 40-hour week, we got, paid overtime. All those things took place in the 30s and then through the 40s. And then, in the 1960s, of course, we got the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act and Medicare and Medicaid and all this stuff, all this incredible stuff that the Republicans like to call communism that came out of Congress and presidents in that period from 1933, with the New Deal, right up until 1981 when Reagan put a screeching halt to this thing with the Reagan Revolution. And so since then, basically every piece of legislation that has been of any consequence at all has principally benefited rich people and giant corporations. And, in 92 when Bill Clinton became or was running for president, he faced a real problem as a result of these two Supreme Court decisions. because there was all this money that was pouring into the Republican Party as a result of the Buckley and Bilotti decisions. And he basically looked around and said, okay, how am I going to do this? How can I run against this? And obviously, decided, well, we're going to have to get in bed with the oligarchs too. And so that's why, he invented this thing he called the Third Way, the New Democrat Alliance and all this kind of stuff, which was basically just like, we're going to be Ronald Reagan light. And so, and that's why, there were some good things that happened out of the Clinton presidency. I don't mean to totally diss Bill Clinton. The problem was the times. I mean, he really basically had no choice if he wanted to win that election as a result of these Supreme Court decisions. And that's why, when Obama became president and he wanted to put into place a national health care system, he borrowed the template that had been written by Republicans at the Heritage Foundation. They're the ones who came up with Obamacare. The Affordable Care Act was originally written by the Heritage Foundation. It was one of their mandates for governing that went back to the Reagan era. Is, just hand everything over to the big corporations, the big insurance companies, and we'll take it from there. So basically for 44 years, we've been living in this oligarchic state, and with the conservatives having declared war on unions, having declared war on women, on women's rights, having declared war on students, we've gone from having basically free college in the United States right up until the 80s. It was free in California. It was inexpensive pretty much everywhere else. When I went to college in the late 60s, I didn't graduate, but to the extent that I did go to college, I could pay for it along with my room and board. Washing dishes at Bob's Big Boy and pumping gas at the Esso station across the street on Trowbridge Road in East Lansing. So you could do that back then. Student debt was unknown. I mean, the only person I knew at that time who had any student debt was a guy who was working on his master's degree in econ. So, who's still an old friend. But and now we have, $1.5 trillion of student debt, which is just burdened, two generations of Americans now. It's hard to start a business. It's hard to start a family. It's hard to buy a house. The student debt is just this massive, crushing burden. And we're the only developed country in the world that has done this, because we were the first among the OECD countries, the 34 Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development countries, the 34 richest countries in the world. And by the way, that goes all the way down to Costa Rica, which is the least populous and wealthy of the 34 countries. Just an anecdote. We had a family vacation, that my sister-in-law organized about 5 years ago in Costa Rica. She rented a house and invited myself and my brothers and their families down there. And Louise and I flew into this, I forget the town in Costa Rica, and the house that Connie had rented was about an hour's drive, maybe a 40-minute drive away. And so we grabbed a cab at the airport, and the cab driver was telling us as we were driving out there, telling us how his son had just graduated from medical school. And we're like, whoa, that's really cool. How'd you do that on a cab driver's salary? And he's like, oh, medical school is free here. All college is free here. And he says, by the way, medicine is free here too. It's like we have a national healthcare system and we have free college. We don't have an army, but life is good. So anyhow, we're the only country in the OECD that has student debt. We're literally the only one where student debt is a thing. I mean, there are obviously people who go into debt and they want to go to fancy schools and things like that, but as the norm. We're the only OECD country, the only one of these 34 developed countries, where medical debt breaks roughly 500,000 families a year have to declare bankruptcy because of medical debt. People lose their homes, they lose their families, they lose their jobs, they lose everything. 500,000 American families every year. The total number, if you add up all the other 34 OECD countries, Sweden, Denmark, Norway, Germany, France, Italy, just go all the way down to Costa Rica, the total is zero. Just here. Again, why? Because oligarchy. Because we ceased to be a functioning democratic republic and we started to become an oligarchy. Jimmy Carter was on my radio program about 8 or 9 years ago, and I asked him what he thought about Citizens United. In fact, it was the year after Citizens United, it must have been 2011. And he said, and this clip lives on in the internet, it's really easy to Google. He said, America's no longer a democracy, we're now an oligarchy, with unlimited political bribery as a result of these Supreme Court decisions. You know, Buckley, Bilotti, and then Citizens United, and then McCutcheon after that. So here we are, you know, living in an oligarchy. Well, that's a bit of a problem, because the thing about oligarchy is that oligarchy is almost always a transitional form of government. It's very rarely a stable form of government. In fact, I can't think of a single example where oligarchy is a stable form of government. And the reason why is because when the rich people start grabbing everything and the poor people are getting screwed 16 ways to Sunday and they know it, they tend to rise up. And then one of two things happens. Either the people in power stomp on them, squash them like a bug, and then your oligarchy has become autocracy, or the people who rise up successfully overthrow the oligarchy and you go back to being a democracy, which, by the way, is what happened in 1933. We were moving aggressively in the direction of oligarchy throughout the 1920s, the so-called Roaring Twenties. The Roaring Twenties sounds like a wonderful time. The standard of living of average working people actually went down during the Roaring Twenties. What was roaring about it was rich people were getting insanely rich. And you know, so some social scientists, I'm forgetting the name of the guy, but he wrote a book about this, have discovered that basically there's only four ways to end oligarchy. Plague, that's what ended oligarchy in the 13th and 15th centuries and led to the Renaissance and the Enlightenment. Plague literally broke the oligarchy. Revolution. That's what we had here in 1776. We had a massive economic crash in 1771, followed by the American Revolution, and we broke the British oligarchy or the British-controlled oligarchy here. Plague, revolution. Let me check my notes here. Massive economic collapse, which is what happened in the 1930s. That was the example I just gave you. And massive war. War that destroys enough infrastructure of a country that it breaks the oligarchy itself. This is what happened to Japan and Germany, to the oligarchies of Japan and Germany in the 1930s, in the 1940s. So basically, it's these four ways that oligarchy gets broken. And my concern is that we're far enough down this oligarchy road that it's not going to change just because of an election. We can do our best, right? And we have to. We have no choice. We have to get everybody we know registered to vote. We need to push back on everything, all this gerrymandering and all this other stuff that's going on. But basically, those four things are all like in extremis, right? They're all sufficiently violent to shake society enough that the oligarchs lose their grip on wealth and power, and then that wealth and power gets redistributed back down to the average people. We have been here before in America. In 1798, Eli Whitney invented this machine called the cotton gin. And the most time-consuming part of processing cotton, or the whole cotton production process, is picking the seeds up. These seeds are real sticky, and the little cotton fibers stick into them. They grow right through the seeds, So what the cotton gin did is it was a big drum with like screen on it, and then it had these things with these little hooks that reached in and pulled the cotton fibers out and left behind the seeds. And you'd hook it up to a horse walking in a circle, turning the thing, and that one machine could do the work of 50 enslaved people. And so what happened in the South, Whitney got an investor in the early 1800s, like around 1804, 1805, and by 1815, he was aggressively marketing the cotton gin in the South, but it was a very expensive machine. And the only people who could afford to buy it were the very large plantations. And so what happened during this period of time from 1815 till around 1830 is that these very large plantations they were 50 times more efficient than the small cotton operations. And so they just wiped them out. And during that period of time, the South ceased to be anything resembling a functioning democracy, because about 1,000 families in the southern states, what became the Confederate States, about 1,000 families basically seized first economic control of the South, created an oligarchy, and then seized political control of the South and created tyranny, basically. Democracy ended. By 1845, there was no democracy in the South. Every opposition newspaper had been shut down. Every anti-slavery newspaper had been shut down. But not just the abolition movement. If you stood up to these oligarchs in any way, even if you were a white man, you would get lynched. People were imprisoned. You know, they would read your vote, and if you voted the wrong way, you could get beat up or have your house caught on fire. So we had a full-blown oligarchic tyranny in the southern states by 1850, full on. And then they started looking at the north going, this is a bad example we got up here, this democracy that's going on. And we're going to take it down. We're going to turn the whole North American continent into a damn oligarchy. And of course that, you know, 700,000 people died in that war. And but the point is that we have been here before. And sadly, they don't teach this history in schools. In fact, I was telling Michael before when we moved to Atlanta back in 1982, I think it was, and my son was 7 or 8 years old, and one night we were having dinner, and I said, you know, he was in the local public school in Atlanta, and I said, or suburban Atlanta, it was Marietta, Marjorie Taylor Greene's district. And I said, you know, what did you learn in school today? And he says, oh, today we studied the war on Northern aggression. So, I mean, granted, that was 30 years ago, but I suspect they're still doing it, you know. So there's this interesting theory about every 80 years. Those of you who listen to the program a lot know I've talked about this before. Strauss and Howe wrote this book called The Fourth Turning. And they suggested that basically every 80 years there is this kind of reboot that happens in the United States. And it follows a particular pattern, that there is an economic crash. That economic crash is followed by a war. That war is then followed by basically a progressive rebooting of society. And so in 1771 we had the Great Crash that was followed by the American Revolutionary War. 80 years after that, you had the Great Crash of 1856, followed by the Civil War. 80 years after that, you had the Great Crash of 1929, followed by the Second World War. And 80 years ago, this year, World War II ended. And they've got this whole theory about why, that there are these four generations. Number one, that it takes about 80 years for people to forget the hard-learned lessons. For example, you know, when Phil Gramm in 1999 got up on the floor of the Senate, I think he was your senator, as I recall, got up on the floor of the Senate and said, you know, this Glass-Steagall Act that says that investment banks can't gamble, you know, your local retail bank can't gamble with your money. He said, you know, from 1934 or 5, he said, we don't need that anymore. Look at it, it's been almost 80 years and there hasn't been a crash. So, you know, let's just get rid of that. And of course, that led us right to the crash of 2008, you know, the big Bush crash. So number one, people forget, because all the people who are, you know, who remember and are loud enough to have anybody pay attention to them are dead, or they're, you know, so elderly that nobody's paying attention, number one. And number two, he said that there's these four generations that happen. You take the generation that lives through the crash and the war. They produce a generation that are the quiet builders. They just want to put the country back together. We've been through hell. We want to rebuild the country. That's my father's generation, the greatest generation. That generation then produces a generation that says, well, our parents worked their asses off, and you know, we're grateful that the country's intact, but hey, let's have a good time, or let's experience enlightenment. You know, this is, and again, every 80 years you find one of these generations. The one before the 60s was the Emerson Thoreau generation, you know, after which this church is named. And so that generation, you know, goes off in search of spiritual enlightenment or LSD or whatever. That was my generation. And then that generation gives birth to a generation that says, you know, our parents just sat around and, you know, gazed at their navels and meditated, or, you know, dropped acid or smoked pot or whatever. And what did it get them? I mean, you know, screw that. I'm going to get rich. And so that generation then, in their headlong rush to get rich, to you know, become rich and famous, produced the next crash. And now we're 80 years, you know, and now the cycle begins all over again. And they go back and they look at each one of these four generations over every cycle, all the way back to the War of the Roses, all the way back to the 1500s in North America. And of course, there's similar patterns that happen in Europe and in Asia as well. They just don't always align on the timeline. So what do we do about this? What do we do about the possibility, or in my opinion, the probability, that Donald Trump is, in response to the people rising up against oligarchy, which we're seeing right now all across the country, is developing a private police force that's answerable only to the Führer. In fact, the SS, what that word in German means literally is a protection force. It was Hitler's private police, right? So you've got him creating this agency that now has a larger budget than the entire federal prison system, a larger budget. ICE has a larger budget than most countries' militaries, larger than the Russian military, which is in the middle of a war. So you've got that. You've got Republicans saying, you know, we're just going to hell with democracy. We don't care. You know, we are not going to lose elections anymore because we're going to pre-rig them. We're going to set up, you know, we're going to make sure that we are not going to lose these things. So we've got, you know, we're actively right now in the process of moving from oligarchy into tyranny. And you know, intimidating judges and arresting lawmakers and arresting mayors and, you know, all this. These are all the early warning signs that this is going to happen. And like I said, it's extremely, while it's important that we do everything we can politically to fight this, it's extremely unlikely, given history, that alone will stop them. In all probability, what's going to stop them is that Trump's insane economic activity is going to produce a major depression, or at least a really severe recession, and his insane international politics, you know, moving two nuclear subs off the coast of Russia and basically telling China, you know, yeah, you want Taiwan, have at it, could lead to World War III. So we may well be on the edge of another crash and another world war. And hopefully it won't be a nuclear world war, but, you know, it could be a real mess. If that happens, that could be the thing that breaks the oligarchy here in the United States for the fourth time since the founding of this republic. And then the question is, what will come out of that? Will another progressive renewal come out of that? I mean, the American Revolution produced a progressive renewal, the first democracy in 3,000 years, you know, functional democracy. The Civil War created a progressive renewal, the end of slavery, and Abraham Lincoln, you know, with the Morrill Act, creating 74 free universities across the United States, the land-grant colleges, the coast-to-coast railroads, infrastructure, all kinds of amazing things. Of course, the crash in World War II produced a progressive reboot in the New Deal and the Great Society. So either it will become that, or this will be the one that's the exception to these three previous ones, and the Republicans, the Trumps, the whatever, will continue to hold power, and we will basically, in 10 years, be Russia, you know, be a country very much like that. And the thing, in my opinion, that is, because I think that it may not be a Great Depression like the 1930s when one-third of America is unemployed, but it may well be 10%, 15% of America is unemployed. It may not be an all-out war like World War II or the Civil War or the American Revolution. It may be more just a lot of warfare activity that just breaks the bank. But the thing, in my opinion, what will bring us out of that and into a positive future is if enough of us are prepared for it. If we're active, if we're waking people up. This is why I, you know, I'm way past retirement age. And this is why I keep doing this radio program, is because we've got to wake people up. We've got to inform people. We've got to prepare for this, because this could be an extraordinary opportunity. It could be the thing that produces an American renewal, that produces the next step. And not just for us, but for the rest of the developed world, because right now, you know, fascism is on the march. You're seeing these right-wing parties. You know, you now have a right-winger in charge of Italy. You've got a right-winger rising in France. You've got right-wingers in, we were just in Sweden recently. The right-wing party there is really, so, you know, here comes an opportunity, perhaps. And even if none of this happens, even if we just kind of sputter along for a while, I really think that there is, we're on the verge of a breaking point, like we were in basically 1856. I think the times right now are very similar to 1856 when we had the Great Panic, which then led to the Civil War. So I don't mean to depress you. I actually see this as, you know, I realize, you know, a depression and a war is a horrible thing, and a lot of people are hurt very badly by these things, and I'm not hoping for them. But I think it's pretty inevitable, given what Trump is doing. I mean, we're starting to see the economy slowing down already. And we just need to be ready for this. We need to have people understand where this all came from. And that, in a way, you know, this all goes back to Edmund Burke and Russell Kirk and those crackpots who thought that, you know, it's just a dangerous and horrible thing that average working people have a say in the marketplace, that women have rights equal with men, that we create a more or less colorblind society, that union rights are recognized, and all these sorts of things. So your job, my commission to you, is to share this message, is to wake people up. We've got to be the awakeners. We've got to be the ones who go out and share this message and inform people about what's going on and what can be done and how this world can be made a much better place. Because I think, you know, at the end of the day, I'm frankly an optimist, and I'm seeing the birth pains of a new society, of a very positive new society. And birth is painful. You know, I delivered two of my three children. I mean, my wife says, no, you didn't deliver them. I caught them. But you get my point. I mean, I've been there, seen that, right? So this is the work that we have to do. So that's my message. And again, thank you so much. KPFT is part of this. This is the work that we've got to do. And thank you so much for your support of KPFT. Thanks for showing up tonight.
We've been listening to author and progressive political commentator Tom Hartman from an August 9th visit with KPFT listeners. This is the Progressive Forum on KPFT. And now it's time for a bird's eye view with Lillian Kerr. A bird's eye view, a woman's perspective with Lillian Kerr. This information about Muriel Gardner, American activist during World War II, comes from the website A Mighty Girl. Muriel Gardner grew up as the sole owner of an estate worth the equivalent of over $90 million today. But when fascists took power in her adopted home in Austria during World War II, the heiress used her wealth and power to save the lives of resistance members and later other people at risk of being targeted by the Gestapo. Known as Mary, she was the only known American woman to aid the Austrian resistance, despite the incredible risk to herself. She was inspired to join their efforts in 1934 after watching a funeral procession for people who had died fighting the fascists. They could not cancel out the feelings that had been building up within me these past few days, she observed. Indignation, anger, and an imperative need to continue the struggle, hopeless though it might be. Gardiner used her apartment as a base of operations. Friends would send people in need to her, and she would arrange for fake papers and help them with travel expenses. She also rented a second apartment to hide resistance leader Joseph Boutinger and carried messages between him and the rest of the underground resistance movement. At one point, she was even questioned by the Gestapo. I had not foreseen the physical aspects, my wildly beating heart, the weakness in my knees, nor had I experienced in my imagination the panic that now overwhelmed me, she recalled later. Fortunately, it was a routine interview, and they left, not suspecting her work. Throughout and following the war, Gardner also helped with the resettlement and refugee efforts, lobbying for visas and sending food packages to families in Europe. Among her efforts, she co-founded the Emergency Rescue Committee, which later merged with the International Relief Association to become the International Rescue Committee, or IRC. She wanted no thanks, says Sheila Eisenberg, Gardner's biographer. She believed in freedom. The freedom that comes from having the financial security to live one's own best life. For more information on this remarkable woman, Muriel Gardner, please visit the website for the Smithsonian, where you can find information about the biography of this remarkable American woman
who collaborated with the resistance against the Nazis in Austria. And this has been Lillian Kerr with a bird's eye view.
This is the Progressive Forum on KPFT. Up next, it's Letters from an American with Heather Cox Richardson.
August 20th, 2025. President Donald J. Trump created a firestorm yesterday when he said that the Smithsonian Institution, the world's largest museum, education, and research complex, located mostly in Washington, D.C., focuses too much on how bad slavery was. But his objection to recognizing the horrors of human enslavement is not simply white supremacy. It is the logical outcome of the political ideology that created MAGA. It is the same ideology that leads him and his loyalists to try to rig the nation's voting system to create a one-party state. That ideology took shape in the years immediately after the Civil War, when black men and poor white men in the South voted for leaders who promised to rebuild their shattered region, provide schools and hospitals, as well as desperately needed prosthetics for veterans, and develop the economy with railroads to provide an equal opportunity for all men to work hard and rise. Former Confederates, committed to the idea of both their racial superiority and their right to control the government, loathed the idea of black men voting. But their opposition to black voting on racial grounds ran headlong into the 15th Amendment to the Constitution, which, after it was ratified in 1870, gave the U.S. government the power to make sure that no state denied any man the right to vote on account of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. When white former Confederates nonetheless tried to force their black neighbors from the polls, Congress in 1870 created the Department of Justice, which began to prosecute the Ku Klux Klan members who had been terrorizing the South. With racial discrimination now a federal offense, elite white Southerners changed their approach. They insisted that they objected to black voting not on racial grounds, but because black men were voting for programs that redistributed wealth from hardworking white people to black people, since hospitals and roads would cost tax dollars, and white people were the only ones with taxable property in the Reconstruction South. Poor black voters were instituting, one popular magazine wrote, socialism in South Carolina. In contrast to what they insisted was the federal government's turn towards socialism, former Confederates celebrated the American cowboys who were moving cattle from Texas to railheads first in Missouri and then northward across the plains, mythologizing them as true Americans. Although the American West depended on the federal government more than any other region of the country, Southern Democrats claimed the cowboy wanted nothing but for the government to leave him alone so he could earn prosperity through his own hard work with other men in a land where they dominated indigenous Americans, Mexicans, and women. That image faded during the Great Depression and World War II as Southerners turned with relief to federal aid and investment. Like them, the vast majority of Americans, Democrats, Independents, and Republicans, turned to the federal government to regulate business, provide a basic social safety net, promote infrastructure, and support a rules-based international order. This way of thinking became known as the liberal consensus. But some businessmen, furious at the idea of regulation and taxes, set out to destroy the liberal consensus that they believed stopped them from accumulating as much money as they deserved. They made little headway until the Supreme Court in 1954 unanimously decided that segregation in public schools was unconstitutional. 3 years later, Republican President Dwight D. Eisenhower federalized the Arkansas National Guard and mobilized the 101st Airborne Division to protect the black students at Little Rock Central High School. The use of tax dollars to protect black rights gave those determined to destroy the liberal consensus an opening to reach back and rally supporters with the racism of Reconstruction. Federal protection of equal rights was a form of socialism, they insisted, and just as their predecessors had done in the 1870s, they turned to the image of the cowboy as the true American. When Arizona Senator Barry Goldwater, who boasted of his Western roots and wore a white cowboy hat, won the Republican nomination for president in 1964, convention organizers chose to make sure that it was the delegation from South Carolina, the heart of the Confederacy, that put his candidacy over the top. The 1965 Voting Rights Act protected black and brown voting, giving the political parties the choice of courting either those voters or their reactionary opponents. President Richard Nixon cast the die for the Republicans when he chose to court the same Southern white supremacists that backed Goldwater to give him the win in 1968. As his popularity slid because of U.S. involvement in Vietnam and Cambodia and the May 1970 Kent State shooting, Nixon began to demonize women's libbers as well as Black Americans and people of color. With his determination to roll back the New Deal, Ronald Reagan doubled down on the idea that racial minorities and women were turning the U.S. into a socialist country. His welfare queen was a Black woman who lived large by scamming government services. After 1980, women and racial minorities voted for Democrats over Republicans. And as they did so, talk radio and later personalities on the Fox News Channel hammered on the idea that these voters were ushering socialism into the United States. After the Democrats passed the 1973 National Voter Registration Act, often called the Motor Voter Act, to make registering to vote in federal elections easier, Republicans began to insist that Democrats could win elections only through voter fraud. Increasingly, Republicans treated Democratic victories as illegitimate and worked to prevent them. In 2000, Republican operatives rioted to shut down a recount in Florida that might have given Democrat Al Gore the presidency. Then, when voters elected Democratic President Barack Obama in 2008, Republican operatives launched Operation Red Map, Republican Redistricting Majority Project, to take control of state houses before the 2010 census and gerrymander states to keep control of the House of Representatives and prevent the Democrats from passing legislation. In that same year, the Republican-dominated Supreme Court reversed a century of campaign finance restrictions to permit corporations and other groups from outside the electoral region to spend unlimited money on elections. 3 years after the Citizens United decision, the Supreme Court gutted the Voting Rights Act that protected minority voting. Despite the Republican thumb on the scale of American elections by the time he ran in 2016, Trump made his political career on the idea that Democrats were trying to cheat him of victory. Before the 2016 election, Trump's associate Roger Stone launched a Stop the Steal website asking for donations of $10,000 because, he said, if this election is close, they will steal it. Donald Trump thinks Hillary Clinton and the Democrats are going to steal the next election, the website said. A federal judge had to bar Stone and his Stop the Steal colleagues from intimidating voters at the polls in what they claimed was their search for election fraud. In 2020, of course, Trump turned that rhetoric into a weapon designed to overturn the results of a presidential election. Just today, newly unredacted filings in the lawsuit Smartmatic brought against Fox News included text messages showing that Fox News Channel personalities knew the election wasn't stolen, but Jesse Waters mused to Greg Gutfeld, think about how incredible our ratings would be if Fox went all in on Stop the Steal. Jeanine Pirro, now the U.S. Attorney for the District of Columbia, boasted of how hard she was working for Trump and the Republicans. In 40 years, Republicans went from opposing Democrats' policies to insisting that Democrats were socialists who had no right to govern, to the idea that Republicans have a right to rig the system to keep voters from being able to elect Democrats to office. Now they appear to have gone to the next logical step, that democracy itself must be destroyed to create permanent Republican rule in order to make sure the government cannot be used for the government programs Americans want. Trump is working to erase women and minorities from the public sphere while openly calling for a system that makes it impossible for voters to elect his opponents. The new Texas maps show how these two plans work together. People of color make up 60% of the population of Texas, but the new maps would put white voters in charge of at least 26 of the state's 38 districts. According to Texas State Representative Vince Perez, it will take about 445,000 white residents to secure a member of Congress, but about 1.4 million Latino residents or 2 million Black residents to elect one. In order to put those maps in place, the Republican Texas House Speaker has assigned state troopers to police the Democratic members to make sure they show up and give the Republicans enough lawmakers present to conduct business. Today, that police custody translated to Texas Representative Nicole Collier being threatened with felony charges for talking on the phone from a bathroom to Democratic National Committee Chair Ken Martin Senator Cory Booker, a Democrat of New Jersey, and Democratic California Governor Gavin Newsom. Republicans have taken away the liberty and now the voice of a black woman elected by voters to represent them in the government. This is a crisis far bigger than Texas. When Trump says that our history focuses too much on how bad slavery was, he is not simply downplaying the realities of human enslavement. He is advocating a world in which black people, people of color, poor people, and women should let elite white men lead and be grateful for that paternalism. It is the same argument elite enslavers made before the Civil War to defend their destruction of the idea of democracy to create an oligarchy. When Trump urges Republicans to slash voting rights to stop socialism and keep him in power, he makes the same argument former Confederates made after the war to keep those who would use the government for the public good from voting. Led by Donald Trump, MAGA Republicans are trying to take the country back to the past, rewriting history by imposing the ideology of the Confederacy on the United States of America. But that effort depends on Republicans buying into the idea that only women and minorities want government programs. That narrative is falling apart as cuts to the government slash programs on which all Americans depend, and older white Americans take to the streets. Today, with the chants of those protesting Trump's takeover of Washington, D.C. echoing in the background, White House Deputy Chief of Staff Stephen Miller told reporters, "We're not going to let the communists destroy a great American city. These stupid white hippies all need to go home and take a nap because they're all over 90 years old. And we're going to get back to the business of protecting the American people and the citizens of Washington, D.C.
This is the Progressive Forum on KPFT. Now it's time for Larry Krizan with the news.
This is the news on the Progressive Forum. In another cruel and inhuman action, the Trump State Department announced on Saturday that it would stop issuing visas to children from Gaza in desperate need of medical care. This barbarous action came after an online pressure campaign was launched by Laura Loomer, a far-right deranged influencer close to Donald Trump, who describes herself as a proud Islamophobe. Loomer blatantly lied, claiming on social media that the humanitarian organization Heal Palestine is mass importing Gazans into the U.S. under the false claim of humanitarian aid. Heal Palestine is a U.S.-based humanitarian organization that has been evacuating severely wounded Palestinian children from Gaza for medical treatment in the United States. Heal Palestine strongly condemned the U.S. decision to halt the wounded children's visa. Heal Palestine emphasized that it provides urgent medical aid and ensures that treated children and their accompanying family members are safely returned to Palestine. In addition, these children and family members are screened by the Israeli regime before they can even leave Gaza. Heal Palestine stated, "Our mission gives children a renewed chance at life, whether through life-saving surgery or the ability to walk again. U.S. tax dollars do not fund this treatment. This is a medical treatment program, not a refugee resettlement program." Humanitarian organizations and aid groups have condemned the decision as it blocks critically ill children from receiving life-saving treatment here in the United States. The Council on Islamic American Relations said the block on visas was the latest sign that the intentional cruelty of President Trump's Israel First administration knows no bounds. The council added that it was deeply ironic that the Trump administration was meanwhile rolling out the red carpet for racist and indicted war criminals from the Israeli government. The Islamic Republic of Iran and the world noted that Tuesday, August 19th, marked 72 years since the United States and Britain plotted a coup against the democratically elected government of Iranian Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh to revive the dictator rule of Shah Mohammad Reza Pahlavi. The coup and the subsequent U.S. support for the ruthless military regime under Mohammad Reza Shah came with grave implications. This coup played a major role in shaping the Iranian perceptions of the United States, which at the time a new imperialist that had entered the course of the competition with the British and Russians to gain control of Iran's vast resources. The coup was primarily motivated by the desire to protect British oil interests in Iran's specifically after then-Prime Minister Mossadegh had nationalized the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company. The coup plot was formally approved by U.S. President Dwight D. Eisenhower. The United States CIA played the leading role in a covert operation which was called Operation Ajax. This event involved the CIA and British intelligence MI6 orchestrating a series of actions including disinformation, military campaigns, and CIA agents creating unrest in the Iranian capital, Tehran. In the aftermath of the coup, Mohammad Reza Pahlavi reasserted his cruel autocratic rule and negotiated a 1954 agreement with the British. This returned the ownership of Iranian oil to a consortium of Western companies until 1979, the year the Islamic Revolution became victorious. The continuing illegal U.S. intervention in Iran is part of a broader arc in American foreign policy. That policy enacts the overthrow of countries that refuse to become puppet governments controlled by the United States, no matter which corrupt political party is in office in America. Analysis of data sets reveals that the United States government has waged over 500 international military interventions since its founding in 1776. In another scandal for the Trump Department of Justice, a senior Israeli cybersecurity official facing serious pedophilia charges has fled the United States after he was arrested in a law enforcement pedophile sting operation in the Las Vegas, Nevada area of Henderson. The Israeli Tom Artyom Alexandrovich was arrested August the 6th by Las Vegas police during a multi-agency investigation targeting online child predators. The Israeli is a high-ranking figure in Israel's National Cyber Directorate working for Benjamin Netanyahu. Local police statements indicate Alexandrovich was one of eight individuals apprehended as part of the sting. The Israeli cyber official was charged with the felony offense of luring a child with a computer for sex acts and later released on $10,000 bail. The accused pedophile then was allowed to return to Israel, prompting questions about how and why a foreign national accused of such a crime was allowed to leave the United States before facing his trial. The scandal has provoked widespread outrage and online debate, with critics accusing Israeli and U.S. authorities of assisting the accused pedophile Alexandrovich to evade United States justice. Observers question why the Israeli Artyom Alexandrovich was allowed to leave the U.S. despite the severity of these allegations. The Alexandrovich case has further inflamed concerns over what critics call Israeli exceptionalism in Western legal systems. This is the idea that Israeli nationals and their institutions are shielded from accountability due to political alliances, particularly in the United States. This story continues to develop with the United States feds wanting to place the blame on Nevada local law enforcement, which appears specious. A deeper investigation of this story can be found online at the Gray Zone. In Sudan, Doctors Without Borders reported that at least 40 people there have died in Darfur during Sudan's worst cholera outbreak in years. This vast western Sudan region has been hardest hit in the year-long health crisis. The region is already devastated by over 2 years of civil war between the Sudanese army and the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces. Across Sudan, health officials have reported 2,470 cholera-related deaths and nearly 100,000 suspected cases since August of last year. Cholera is an acute intestinal infection spread through contaminated food and water, which can kill a person within hours if untreated. Simple oral rehydration can save lives, but access to clean water remains scarce in many areas of the Sudan. Doctors Without Borders said that mass civilian displacement caused by the conflict has worsened the crisis by denying people access to safe water. In the North Darfur region's Tawila, Doctors Without Borders describes the situation there as being the most extreme, where 380,000 Sudanese people have fled ongoing fighting around El Fasher. According to United Nations figures, those Sudanese who fled Tawila now survive on just 3 liters of water per day, which is less than half the emergency standard minimum of 7.5 liters per day. Doctors Without Borders said that in displacement and refugee camps, families often have no choice but to drink from contaminated sources and therefore many contract cholera. This tragedy, along with many others in the world, are ignored by Western media and their politicians. And in the final story, in the far northwest territories of Canada, an agreement has been made to give stewardship over an area twice the size of Florida to a coalition of First Nations Native peoples. In July, partners signed the grant agreement that secures $300 million from the Government of Canada and $75 million from private donors. The agreement included the commitments needed to begin on-the-ground work. The agreement is titled Northwest Territories, Our Land for the Future, and it is the largest agreement of its kind in North America. For the purposes of conservation, the $375 million will help build sustainable, resilient local economies not based on resource extraction. Because of this, 150,000 square miles of land and fresh water will be protected in the long term. The land area of the Northwest Territories is equal to that